Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him. The sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, this is Reset, and I'm Sigal Samuel, filling in for Ariel Dimross. I'm a staff writer for Vox, and I focus on technology and artificial intelligence and how they affect vulnerable populations, for better and worse. Today, we're going to talk about how tech is being used to monitor and treat the coronavirus outbreak, where it all began, in China. China's response to the virus has been very techy. They've used robots that disinfect hospital rooms, drones that yell at you if you're not wearing a mask, facial recognition cameras that tip off police that you might have a fever. This sort of tech could help minimize the risks of a pandemic. And even if it costs people their privacy, maybe that's okay if it lets them keep something more valuable, their lives, right? But what happens after the coronavirus panic ends? Will invasive surveillance technologies just be packed away? Or will they become the new normal, eroding people's privacy not only in China, but also in places like the US? Hey, Rebecca, how are you? Where are you?
I'm working from home, trying to avoid being out in public like everyone else.
Some light social distancing.
Light social distancing.
Okay. Rebecca Heilweil is a reporter for Open Sourced at Vox. She's been covering the rollout of tech products being used to stop the spread of coronavirus, especially in China.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things we've seen is how, you know, technology that was already being developed or, you know, already exist in China is kind of being modified or sort of retargeted to kind of address this outbreak. And I think the big focus has been preventing the spread of infection. And one thing that we've seen that I think is kind of positive and interesting are these robots that are meant to make sure that healthcare workers and people who have this virus are not necessarily directly interacting. There's this one Danish company that's providing a bunch of hospitals in China with a type of robot that goes into rooms and uses ultraviolet light to sort of disinfect it. But, you know, we're also seeing technologies that I might call a little bit more serious or, you know, more associated with the surveillance structure that does exist in China and seeing how it applies in sort of the case of trying to prevent a pandemic and control an outbreak.
Okay, cool. So I want to get a little bit more into the privacy and stuff like that a bit later, but just to break this down a bit. So first thing you mentioned is robots. So we have robots now being used to disinfect rooms. It sounds like communicate with sick patients and maybe deliver them some medications, right?
Yeah. It's sort of a wide range of applications. I think the main premise is that these robots are really helpful for trying to keep those health workers safe.
And this is spreading beyond just China, right? So I read that near Seattle, there's a robot that went in with carrying a stethoscope that went in to treat an American who's diagnosed with coronavirus. I also saw these videos going around on Chinese media where you see drones kind of flying up to the top floors of an apartment building and from the balconies taking the temperature of the residents, which was kind of crazy to see.
Yeah. I encountered a company that was saying its drones could also spread disinfectant. So while the drones were going around trying to patrol or monitor areas, they were also spraying disinfectant. You know, I think there's this general theme of automation kind of stepping in between traditionally human to human interaction. But, you know, once we put devices with cameras in them and that can sort of function autonomously, it's always important to keep in mind that they usually can do a lot of other things once they have those abilities.
One other thing I've heard about is these sort of thermometer guns, which is not a term that I had personally encountered until the coronavirus outbreak. Like, what is that, first of all?
They're kind of extended devices. And I guess the premise is that you don't have to be so close to someone to take their temperature. But, you know, the New York Times did a great report on this and said traditionally these aren't as accurate as maybe would want them to be. And I think we should be asking the same question about a lot of the technologies that are being sort of pushed to us as methods of taking temperature without the traditional thermometer. And I think that's true, certainly, of facial recognition companies that are saying, oh, our technology can also guess whether someone might have a fever.
Yeah, I even saw this video that Paul Mazur, a New York Times journalist, just tweeted out showing basically these police officers on the streets of Shanghai wearing these facial recognition-enabled helmets that let them just look at you and all the people who are, you know, walking across the street. And as they're looking at you, they see this heat map of your body with, like, it's orange, it's red, it's 36 degrees Celsius, it's 37 degrees Celsius. And so they can theoretically be telling just by looking at you in the street if you have a fever.
That's the premise. I can't say whether it works or not, but that seems to be the promise. You know, it goes back to the same thing. Once you put a camera someplace, it can do more than just the initial task. So in this case, these were cameras that maybe were initially outfitted with facial recognition capabilities. And now the companies are saying, hey, we can do something else as well.
And my understanding is that AI earlier on in the outbreak was also used, particularly in China, to study the outbreak spread. In China, your national ID is linked to your mobile phone number. So they can identify who you are and by your phone track exactly where you were traveling in a given city at a given time, and then notify the people who are on the same train or in the, you know, the same platform, hey, you know, you might want to get tested and that kind of thing. And that can be really helpful in the case of, you know, a pandemic risk like this. But I guess I wonder if you think it makes sense for citizens to give up some of their privacy if that can help combat a huge public health crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really tough question. I think I'd like to flip the premise of that a bit in the sense that, you know, like you say, these were capabilities that the Chinese government already had, right? So
yeah,
in a way, what we've seen with the novel coronavirus isn't necessarily the expansion of surveillance. It's really just seeing the existing surveillance capacities on full display. And I think that's something that is important to sort of keep in mind in terms of, you know, giving up your own privacy. I mean, it's important to keep in mind that China has seen the lion's share of these cases and has faced types of questions that, you know, we in the US and maybe in other parts of the world have not had to wrestle with yet. And I think that that's, you know, the average citizen living in China is, you know, facing a really different reality than what we're facing. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we talk about privacy. But, you know,
yeah,
at the same time, any sort of critic of facial recognition or surveillance will tell you, you know, it's worth asking, what is happening to this data? Is it being protected? If we're adding thermal imaging into facial recognition cameras, is that going to go away or will that be there indefinitely? Mm-hmm. You know, and these are things that we really have to wrestle with. And if you're in the US, it's, you know, it's an important opportunity to reflect on what you're comfortable with.
There is something kind of dystopian about an outbreak being used to justify increased surveillance. Coming up after the break, why there's reason to think these new surveillance technologies will become permanent fixtures in China and beyond.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
I've been covering surveillance technology in China for a couple years now, and one of the experts I've often called to help me understand it is Tim Gross. He's a professor of China studies at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think this opportunity provides the Chinese Communist Party with an instance where they can showcase themselves as at the cutting edge of new technology, regardless of whether it's invasive or not. In recent decades, especially in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, kind of the global community saw China as lagging behind or being imitators in terms of technology. But now they're unveiling and kind of unleashing this whole new arsenal of high-tech devices that really showcase just what kind of strides they've made in the last two decades.
Are there actually any examples from the recent past of China instituting invasive surveillance tech and saying, hey, this is to deal with this very particular circumstance, and then it kind of becomes a more widespread or permanent fixture?
Originally, the Chinese Communist Party has used threats of quote-unquote separatism as ways to justify the use of surveillance technology that I think many people would regard as invasive. And we see the quote-unquote grid surveillance system in the Tibet Autonomous Region, which was largely constructed by an individual named Chen Chuanguo, who served as the party secretary of the region. And in 2016, he was promoted to the general secretary of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. And he, although he was transferred or promoted to this new post, he brought his old playbook with him.
Okay, so let me get this straight. This Chinese official designed policies to crack down on the Tibetan people, and because they were so effective, he was then promoted to this top position in Xinjiang, a northwestern region in China. And that's where most Uyghurs live. They're this mostly Muslim minority group. More than 1 million of them have been held in internment camps over the past couple years. And so this guy brought these repressive surveillance policies from Tibet to Xinjiang.
Sure. Yeah. To some extent, you could say that he's the mastermind of this playbook. And so he brought many of the same strategies that he used and also kind of materialized into kind of concrete action. And so he brought those from Tibet into the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, even to the extent of those so-called convenience police stations, which also kind of dot the streets of large cities in Tibet, especially Lhasa. And we saw those being constructed throughout large cities in Xinjiang, especially Urumqi. My last visit to the region in 2017, I did measurements in Uyghur districts, and there was a convenience police station erected about every 200 meters. And of course, these convenience police stations are staffed by law enforcement personnel, and they're equipped with surveillance cameras. And so essentially, it keeps monitoring, or it keeps an eye on and monitors the movements of all people that go back and forth.
So I remember actually talking to you 2 years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. And you said to me, Xinjiang is sort of a laboratory or a testing ground for surveillance tech and drones that then gets exported more broadly elsewhere in China and then around the world. Can I ask you to make sort of an educated guess? What do you think the chances are that the more invasive surveillance tech that China is rolling out now in the wake of the coronavirus might become sort of a permanent feature of life in the country?
Yeah, certainly. I think this is going to be the new norm. But, you know, surprising to me is that talking with colleagues in China and friends in China, that I can't put an estimate on it, and this is all anecdotal, but it's not met with the same reactions that I have with colleagues outside of China who are nonetheless China observers. In other words, many people who are from China or have Chinese citizenship put a lot of faith in their party, and they don't necessarily see this technology as invasive, and rather they have so much confidence in the party that the party's doing this for their own good, meaning not the party's good, but the good of the entire population. And there's almost this blind faith that is not necessarily supporting the use of new technology and the expansion of this technology, but it's certainly, I think, fueling the Chinese Communist Party to act with impunity to, you know, even make otherwise invasive technology more widespread, because there isn't any resistance.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me, particularly in the context of a pandemic risk, that people might actually feel quite reassured that their country, their government has this big data that can be used to monitor how the outbreak is spreading and can be used to treat it potentially. I guess I wonder, how are people going to then draw a line in the sand at some point when hopefully this virus dies down? And then, well, now we've had these technologies roll out, we've kind of gotten used to them. Is there going to come a point where people have to say, okay, that was fine for a special circumstance, but now we're not cool with that for general everyday life?
Well, I mean, that would be the response I would hope for. But unfortunately, I think as new mechanisms are introduced in society, it doesn't take long before it's a new norm. For example, we, you know, consider smart devices in U.S. households. If you had asked people 10 years ago, would they want to put in their households a smart speaker that could recognize mm-hmm. their voice, that you could do shopping on, it knows your location? You know, 10 years ago, people would say, no, either think that would be impossible, or number two, think, oh, no, that's a little bit too weird for me. Yet, you know, it's almost ubiquitous to the U.S. home now. And I see that kind of happening in China, where they're introduced to it, and it's normal. And so they don't have an expectation that the expansion of this technology is unusual. Well, then I don't think there would ever be any resistance to put a stop to it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should just say that, you know, when we were talking earlier about, oh, most Chinese citizens don't necessarily see a problem with this sort of technology, I should probably say, you know, potentially with the exception of Uyghurs and other religious minority groups who are being very severely repressed by them. But yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying in terms of the sort of different cultural norm. I wonder whether if this outbreak really becomes more widespread and serious in the U.S., whether we're going to see our privacy norms shifting around these technologies too.
Yeah, I'm afraid that could be the case. And I was, you know, taken aback the first time I went through immigration in the United States. Instead of actually meeting with a customs officer, my face was scanned, my picture was taken, and I just handed that form in to someone. And so I think to a certain extent, it is already becoming a norm to have this facial recognition. And you know, someone maybe like me and others who are watching what direction the Chinese government is taking its population, that we're a little bit more squeamish when this type of technology is introduced in the United States. But I was, again, really surprised when I overheard conversation of people in line with me at the immigration saying how great and convenient this was, because it really reduced the time it took them from to get from their gate through immigrations and customs and back to their bags. And so people see it as a convenience and don't really think critically about, well, what is actually going on behind those cameras and what's this information being used for and what kind of databases is this information going to be stored in?
Right. I feel like we'll do anything for convenience.
Right. And this package as convenience, I think it's an easy sell for many people.
Could the coronavirus scare actually accelerate the acceptance in the U.S. of these measures that under ordinary circumstances we would be like, no, thank you?
Of course, if this technology is used as a way to reduce the numbers of infected and, of course, to reduce the numbers of deaths, you know, there is a place for this type of technology, but it comes down to, you know, these very cloudy ethical dilemmas of, well, then, you know, what is excessive? And prior to the coronavirus, you had government officials entering Uyghur homes and basically teaching them a new way to wash their hands. And so instead of washing their hands in what's typical in many Islamic communities, you know, using a basin and pouring water, usually three times, and then rinsing, communist officials were going in and making them wash their hands with soap. Right. And so on one hand, we know, you know, looking through all the health experts, that soap makes a difference.
Right.
With the coronavirus. And it's shown to be effective in preventing the disease. So, of course, on one hand, I say, well, this is actually good because it could potentially prevent a widespread outbreak in rural areas in Xinjiang where they lack the medical facilities and professionals to treat an outbreak. On the other hand, I also know that the communist officials were trying to replace the quote-unquote Uyghur way of washing their hands long before the coronavirus. And not all of their motivations behind it were because of hygiene, right? There was also, you know, trying to distance Uyghurs from an Islamic cultural core, right? So again, this is one of those ethical dilemmas. But at what point do we say, okay, we don't need to actually, you know, require us to live a certain way anymore for it to be healthy?
Tim Gross, China expert at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you again.
This is Reset, and I'm Sigal Samuel. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at Sigal Samuel. You can also reach the Reset team by emailing reset@vox.com. We publish episodes three times a week, on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays. So if you haven't already, subscribe to the pod. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or in your favorite podcast app. And if you like what you hear, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. We'll be back on Thursday. Later, nerds.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.